Going to open our House Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities Committee meeting. Today's May 7th, 2009. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 622A. It's our task force on geese control, and would ask Roger Beyer, Marie Gadotti, and Don Anderson to come forward. I remember going to a meeting on geese. This is now back in 95 when I was a Wyden staffer somewhere in near Wheatland Road up there with a lot of people. This is probably the same exact problem, the same issue still going, isn't it?
Except way more.
Except more, yeah, way more geese. Yeah. Wow.
The number of goslings I saw down the road there.
Please.
Okay. My name is Marie Gadotti. I'm here representing myself as a farmer since the early 70s and from the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation and the chair of the Goose Depredation Committee. And I want to thank you for letting us come today before you, and I really want to thank Senator Johnson for putting this bill forward. And what I've handed you is, after the first page, there's kind of an outline of where we've been since 1974 and where we're at today, so that you just have some idea what we have been working on this issue for a long time. My husband and I have been farming full-time since the early 70s. And back in those days, you didn't see a goose of any species. I mean, it just wasn't happening. And then in the 80s, we started to see them start with the duskies and all the problems that with the dusky geese come. Then we started with the other species, and then they started managing for, instead of managing for all geese as one, they started managing for different species, and then we had increases of, we had 25,000 birds in 1984, and today we have 350,000. And that's not counting the 250,000 that are down in the Klamath Basin, the white fronts. So we really have a problem. I mean, my farm on my own, this year we've probably lost $50,000 to $60,000. And that's $50,000 or $60,000 that could go into income tax to help the state of Oregon. So it's been a nuisance for a long time, and we've tried different things, and this task force for us is hopefully a new way to get the attention of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who we sit at the table with, and they more or less tell us it's our problem. So that's why we're here today, and I'll let Senator Johnson speak. Again, I thank her wholeheartedly for getting us here.
Yeah, we kind of like her, too.
Welcome. The bill should pass.
That's why we like her. Yeah, that's right.
But you have to say it, Senator
Johnson. Oh, yeah, you got to say your name and then to get back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. I heard Ms. Gadotti lay out the case for this, and I won't duplicate her testimony, which really I think makes a significant statement about why this is so important. This bill has gotten a lot of yucks. I was crushed that it didn't make the Turkey of the Year award, but there have been lots of jokes about Johnson's goose poop bill. I think that unless people are farmers, unless they're aviators, unless they're public health officials, they don't really know what a serious threat this is. These birds are everywhere. And what they don't eat, they stomp on. What they don't stomp on, they defecate on. What they don't defecate on, it's just a constant cycle, and it's a real cost to agriculture. I think we originally started out this bill with more money for wildlife services. In this budget climate, that wasn't possible. And so in order to keep the issue alive, to get all the relevant people at the table, to try to harmonize the state and federal regulations that cover these migratory birds, we want to create this task force. We're trying to do it at virtually no cost to anybody. We want our work product looked at by ODF&W, though, to make sure that we're getting the benefit of their expertise. I know with the leadership from the agricultural community that have stepped forward on this, and we've heard from people all over the state that we're going to have adequate anecdotal information at the table. We're working with producers of new products that have products that make geese have upset tummies if they eat product covered with this new chemical material. We're trying to find out if we can get that into some testing phases, and so this task force will be able to keep the issue alive. And while it's not the money that we wish we had in Wildlife Services, this allows us to come back to a future legislature with a suite of recommendations to try to deal with this growing problem. So I appreciate you taking the time to hear the bill, and I hope you act favorably on it.
Thank you.
My name's Donald Anderson, and I farm on Sobeys Island. I agree with Marie. We've been working on this since 74, and I just like to point out that when we bought our farm in 1960, geese was a rarity. And today, we are inundated. Some fields are 16 inches high, and the others is down to the ground. They talk of 300,000 to 350,000 birds, and no end to the birds to come. Hopefully this bill will address that problem, and someday I'll see Brad up before a hearing and says, enough is enough geese to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. If that would happen, we have won. Today, the estimates of 300 to 350,000, the range of feed they take is 1 to 3 pounds a day. For 300,000 birds, that takes 100,000 acres for every 36,000 birds. So that's at least 100,000 acres to feed every 100,000 birds. So that's why you see them everywhere. I mean, what they like is short green grass, and whether that's wheat, grass seed, or whatever, lawns and golf courses, that's why we see them. And to ask the state to plant all their refuges, they don't have enough ground. So there's got to be another solution, and hopefully this task force will address it and say how much wildlife of geese do we really need. The other thing that's going to happen is that if the rate we're going in 5 years, we'll be saying ducks are an endangered species because the ducks numbers in our area are slowly going down because of they're being driven out by geese. So it's a wildlife issue, and somebody's got to take a stand someplace, and we hope or the state of Oregon will do it. Thank you.
Representative Shoffler.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
It's
a broken record in this room, and it's because we don't have the will, the majority of us don't have the will, to manage our wildlife. I'm not blaming the department. We, Mr. Chair, and you've attempted to, God bless you, are not managing our wildlife, period. Whether it's clawed or fanged or feathered or finned or pinnipedded. Anyway, I grew up in a home where my oldest brother was quite the hunter, and our freezer was always full of pheasants, ducks, and geese. And he was always especially proud when he came home with a goose. How much of a dent would it put in here to increase the bag limit on these birds? And that's maybe a question for the department, but
you'll find that the ruling force is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. I mean, Brad can do so much, but when they say something, I mean, that's practically law. And so, I mean, I'm hoping that with the state of Oregon behind this, that, you know, he can push back and get a few things changed. That's our only hope.
Mr. Chair and Representative Shoffler, I would just add that this was so serious that my office went to the effort to hire an avian biologist prior to the commencement of the session to begin to look at the range of alternatives, and there was not consistent agreement among the agriculture community. We're going to refine what all we can agree on, but clearly harmonizing our fish and game rules with those of California that I understand have a higher bag limit, longer seasons, those are the sorts of things that we're going to be working on. working on. I hope that the task force engages our federal delegation so that we can drive home the point to them that this is a serious, serious economic problem, public health hazard, and all you need to do is look at the pictures of that brave airline captain landing the plane in the Hudson River to know what a threat it is to transportation. So we're going to use every tool in the toolbox that this task force can agree on to bring forward to the next legislature and give the legislature an opportunity to do whatever we can to mitigate this mounting hazard.
May I follow up? Thank you. I don't shut up after that. You know, thank you, Senator. You're exactly right. Our federal government is doing the job when it comes to mortgage lending and financing and that along those lines. They are not doing the job when it comes to our natural resources, and this is a perfect example. And I look forward to when our fellow Democrats raise the hue and cry on the House floor about not the federal government dropping the ball on regulating financing in this country, but how they've dropped the ball in regulating and letting us take care of our natural resources in this state. But thank you, Senator, for coming here. And you folks, too.
Can I make another comment?
Oh, sure.
One of the things that, just to give you a visual, it sounds like you guys all have it, but we went for 3 hours in October, we went and cut firewood. When we come back, my 30 acres of clover was all but gone in 3 hours. That's how we're dealing with this. We used to be able to have some time off in the winter. We don't go unless I have all my friends lined up to go out and chase the geese. We can save some of our crop by chasing them, but it's a full-time job, and then even out of that, we lost 30 acres of peas because they ate it four times. And they're eating crops that they didn't eat before. They're eating defense rows that they didn't do before. And it's just gotten, the numbers are too big and everything that goes with it. And there is studies on the E. coli effects. And what I want to do is to be able to go home. I want to farm. I want to be profitable. And I want to grow safe food that we all eat and not be with these geese out there. Who knows what's going on in those crops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard, as Representative Schaffer said, in this committee, other committees, from our constituents, the problems with predators. Last week we had the issue about wolves in here. The key to all of it is anything that the federal government touches in natural resources goes to hell in a handbasket, period. Show me one thing that they touch that we don't start having trouble with almost immediately. They don't do management. I would suggest, Senator, that next time you run, you could have a slogan, a goose in every pot.
There you go.
Maybe we could get rid of them.
Or following on Representative Schaffler's, you get a goose with every mortgage closed.
Or your goose is cooked.
Oh, goodness.
We're ready to go, Mr. Chair. Excuse us.
The only thing that... because I have a wife that I love dearly, that I have to say, is when we're over on Hawthorne here near Costco, she likes to remind me that some of the places that used to be the home for some of these geese here are now paved over. And so their habitat is being shifted on to you as we continue to do other things. Doesn't mean you don't manage them. You still don't manage them, but she would shoot me if I didn't mention that man is pushing animals with our pavement into smaller places, and you happen to have one of these places where they like to go. So we got to figure out how to deal with that, too.
In response to that, though, I think with the goose population numbers, I understand what she's saying, and I appreciate that, but when we didn't have any... and then we had 25,084. I don't think the paving over the property is as important as that 350,000 versus 24,000.
Well, I think her point is those 350,000 used to go somewhere else. And
our neighbors to California, and they've raised because of some
paved over all of their places.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that. If you fly over LA. All the places they used to go are paved over now with houses, and so now they're coming to the people like you who take care of their land and don't just pave it over.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
I
know you love aggregate. I'm sorry.
I don't think we've paved over all their habitat. I would submit to you.
You can talk to my wife.
I love your wife almost as much as you do. She's delightful. But we may have paved over a fraction of a percent of their habitat.
Maybe it's just kettle chip she's mad at. I don't know. Representative Wingard.
I thought I could stay quiet, but when you brought your wife into it, now I'm in. Just so we are staying where the facts are, 50% of this state is in public hands, and less than 5% of it is developed. Of the acreage in the state, less than 5%. So there are...
Geese don't go in the woods, though.
It's not all trees, Mr. Chair. I swear it's not all trees.
All right, I've done enough advocacy on behalf of my better half, and I'm done. I just had to say it once. Anything else for this panel? Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Senator, for coming. Okay, Roger, you get to come back up apparently now. And Ron Dobbins and Kurt Melcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing today the Oregon Seed Council and the Oregon Dairy Farmers, both of which have a huge interest in this bill and a lot at stake. Let me give you a visual about the Willamette Valley. First of all, the Willamette Valley is about 2 million acres total. About 25% of that is in urban uses. About 25% of that is forested. These are rough numbers. These aren't exact numbers. That leaves about 50% in agriculture. Of that 50%, 52% of that 50% is in grass seed. We have about 26% of the Willamette Valley in grass seed production today. So when you ask, what are these geese eating? It's grass. And it is my members' crops that is being consumed by these geese. The issue is not that there has been more shifting from agricultural uses to urban uses. The issue is that the geese numbers have exploded. We have different types of geese now than we used to have. And the federal government is managing for the lowest common denominator of these species. So where there may be an abundance of one type of goose, the hunting seasons are being limited because of the lack of another type of goose. These are the issues the task force needs to deal with. Normally, for the past few years, one of the biggest pest problems of my members is voles, which is like a little mouse. Mm-hmm. And they can, because of the geese, they can only use mouse bait underground from September 1st until May 1st on what has been the last few years. This year, last year it started and this year continued. Because the geese are now staying in the valley longer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife had determined that it's not safe to start using above-ground baiting for mice, for voles, until later dates. This year, rather than May 1st, it was delayed until actually tomorrow, May 8th, because the geese just left this week. So another issue that needs to be looked at. For the dairy farmers have a similar but slightly different problem, especially over in the Tillamook area. There is, again, a certain type of goose that is considered threatened. This one type of goose, they say, only winters in the Tillamook Valley. So the dairy farmers there are being, you know, they are, that goose is being managed because of that one small population of geese from a certain area coming from Alaska that's impacting the dairy farmers, even though there are, again, tens of thousands of other geese that they have to be worried about. The issues are not easy. The issues are very complex. There are very many players we have to work with. Obviously, U.S. Fish and Wildlife is the one big common factor, again, like Representative Schaffer said and Representative Krieger said, when it comes to wildlife, it seems like it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is where we have to work with. But that's the law. That's what we have to do. That's what this task force needs to figure out. One issue I want to put on the record right now is that hunters, and I am a hunter, and I support the idea of more goose hunting, better, bigger bag limits, longer seasons into the spring, whatever we can do to keep these animals, these geese moving. But hunters have a tolerance for getting a certain number of these wrong type of geese. And an individual hunter may lose their permit to shoot geese for a single year, but the whole goose season isn't shut down if a goose is killed of the wrong subspecies. in agriculture, we don't seem to have a tolerance. We don't seem to get an allocation of the wrong or of geese. Every time a goose is killed by an agricultural practice, it's a goose killed, and it's you know, it makes the paper. If hunters get a tolerance, why doesn't agriculture get a tolerance? A certain amount of take or something, you know, however you want to put it. I want to put that on the record because that's an issue I want to bring forward to this task force. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I won't take any more of your time. We wholeheartedly support this bill. We support and appreciate Senator Johnson bringing the issue forward. It's not just agriculture. It's airports. It's city parks. It's golf courses. It's lawns, quite frankly, in many neighborhoods. It's becoming lawns where geese are overrunning the place. So please pass this bill forward. Let us get to work. Give us 18 months to get some things put together, come to some agreements, hopefully, and bring something back to this committee in 2011. Maybe if we work really fast, we can bring something back in 2010 if you are here. But give us that opportunity, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Please. Okay. I'm Ron Dobbin. I'm a Washington County farmer. I also used to farm in Columbia County, close to where the Gaddatis were. I've turned in what I figure the impact, financial impact, was on our farm last year. To make my testimony short here, basically experienced all the things all the rest of them have here. I'd like to add in addition to that kind of the frustration and maybe the education that we can get out if we can get this task force put together. In dealing with these geese, a lot of the public doesn't understand the use of pyrotechnics and different things that we've tried, and they will call the police department. And so the next thing you know, the police have to come out and visit with us and check our permits and one thing or another. And so this is another area of frustration. Like to touch too on how smart these birds are. No matter what we try, we use flags, we use coyote silhouettes, we herd them with the ATVs, we use pyrotechnics, we've tried spraying different things on the fields to deter them, and in a matter of a few days they will get used to anything that we have. And to make those things effective, you have to have something to scare them, and like he was addressing to hunting. During the hunting, we can bring hunters out there, and if they get a few birds, then these other things you do quite effective. When they close the hunting season down, which they did in the middle and then after the regular season is closed, any things that we do, they get used to, and you have to increase the amount of time that you spend in these fields. Again, increasing the bag limits and possibly giving permits for the particular farms to protect cropland might be beneficial. Again, these numbers are growing. When I farmed in Columbia County, we went from not having a problem to having to deal with a problem when they were migrating. So you'd spend 2 weeks in the fall and 2 weeks in the spring. Then it became, I believe it was about 87, the problem made its way over into Washington County, and before that we never seen geese up there. To where today it is a full-time job from the first time the crops come out of the ground in October until they leave, which in here I put April 20th, this year it was up into the early days of May. Again, numbers are a significant. You might have 10 to 15,000 that will land in a 40 or 50 acre field, and if you're not there to chase them out in 3 to 4 hours, they can devastate a field. Anyhow, it's a concern, and without me going into a lot of detail here, it's something we hope this task force can address, and hopefully we can find an economic situation. One thing I'd like to touch base on that, the tax aspect of this. I figured last year $89,390, I figured it was impact on the farm. And if you figure that on the state tax portion of that would have been $8,045. The federal tax would have been $22,347. and the Social Security self-employment tax would have been $13,676, which would be a total revenue loss of $44,069. And that's something that, you know, everybody that I talk to in this room is talking about budget cuts. And this is just one small example of why we're having to cut budgets, because these things are cutting in and our revenues are going down. So if we can find something economic to where we can keep these off the crops, we can get our income built back up just with the same efforts we're doing right now. And, you know, it will basically impact people all over the state just from little things for me being able to deal with these birds. And I'll leave you with that today.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You.
Questions?
Mr. Dobbin, you should be the governor. Because you can do simple math.
Okay.
We're gonna raise your taxes, and we don't even have to, because we're sitting on a gold mine all over this state. Okay. It's just unbelievable that this keeps going on. And you're exactly right. You've just made the best argument I've ever heard for anything.
Yeah.
And it's pure simple math, and you're just one farm.
Yeah. Like my brother was down the other day, and he said, "You know, Ron, those tax dollars are disappearing into thin air, going north."
And I need to follow up. Yep. And you know what else? And then good people like you, just like you, all those good, hardworking folks out there, their school district, their fire district, their police department, sheriff, park district, their city, county, will go, "Well, we're sending this nice little tiny property tax issue out to you, and we want you to help us help the community." And you know what? You know what you do? I'm not saying you personally, and I don't blame people for doing this. They throw their arms up and go, "Why, after presenting this, should I pay more taxes into something that isn't doing anything right?" And this problem just mushrooms throughout this community and further divides people. Unbelievable. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
Good choice. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. So Kurt, Brad, Bales, and John McCulley.
We are sitting on a gold mine.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I have with me here today Mr. Brad Bales, our waterfowl program coordinator, or migratory bird program coordinator, I should say. And I'll be relatively brief here and not prolong you listening to me trying to talk with my cold. As was mentioned previously, all migratory birds, including ducks and geese, are managed under the auspices of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, like so many other of the issues that we've talked about with you in this committee here this year, we have to work within a federal management framework and under federal authority. And the primary regulations and regulatory actions are taken by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We do participate in a flyway council, which gives the states an opportunity to participate in the actual season setting in that federal framework. But again, we are one state, and the issues as addressed here are complex, in particular with regard to the cackling candidate geese that we now have here in the Willamette Valley. There is a direct subsistence link to the native Alaskans in the North Alaska, and their need for abundant populations for their own sustenance. And that makes the issue particularly difficult for the service as well as us, Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As was mentioned, the diversity of Canada geese over the years has changed, and the public testimony you heard here is absolutely correct. Back in the 1970s and prior to the 1970s, the wintering Canada goose population in the Willamette Valley totaled about 20,000 birds. Having grown up here myself, I can certainly attest to the fact that Canada geese were a rarity. It was a big thing when I remember my cousins shooting Canada geese, and it was a big deal. It was like, "Hey, we got a goose." Well, that has changed. And primarily the cackling Canada goose population, which we never had here wintering in Oregon, they wintered exclusively in the Central Valley of California. Those birds are now almost exclusively wintering in the Willamette Valley, as well as some other subspecies, but the cacklers are the big the big problem, if you will. Those birds are now, I think, only 5% of their population winters in the Sacramento Valley and the Central Valley, whereas it used to be 100% of them wintered there. The other 95%, frankly, are right here in the Willamette Valley, and that's why we have seen this great explosion in goose numbers. It's not necessarily that the population has increased. It's that their wintering grounds have shifted 400 or 500 miles to the north, and we now have them here in the Willamette Valley. We have, over the years, and we certainly recognize and have worked and tried to work closely with our the producers to try and address these issues, and we've taken a number of actions with regard to hunting seasons and everything we can do within the federal framework. Most importantly, though, in 1998, and perhaps in response, Representative Clem, to your discussion in the mid-90s on the escalating goose problem, we did develop a goose depredation plan for the Willamette Valley. We worked with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on that plan and the flyway partners, including the other states. And unfortunately, that plan was never funded and implemented. So there was a lot of good work that went on there. Has never been implemented. We think this task force could hopefully resurrect the interest in that issue, and we stand by ready to support the task force in its efforts. With that, I do have, as I mentioned, I do have Brad Bales here. If there's specific questions about these geese populations, seasons, happy to have Brad answer those. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt. I know you're working hard, and I'm not here to beat up on the department. I have great respect for the work you guys and gals are doing. You said everything within the federal framework. Is that, are we maxed out? Bag limit, whatever else. Every single thing the department in this state and this legislature can possibly do within the federal framework is being done. Is that, am I hearing you correctly?
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, with regard to the actual hunting seasons, that is accurate. We're given very specific frameworks that we have to work under, and we have maximized those hunting opportunities within that framework. Now, are there ways we can shift seasons? And we're happy to discuss those through this task force. But generally speaking, and I defer to Brad if he wants to answer it more directly, I think we are, with regard to hunting, we are within our limits of the federal framework. Brad, is that generally accurate?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Brad Bales. I'm the Migratory Game Bird Coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Currently, under the frameworks that are given to us now, we are trying to maximize harvest as much as possible. One of the underlying issues is with the requirement of the hunter education, the mandatory hunter check stations, that cost the state, with no federal assistance whatsoever, at least $200,000 to $225,000 a year just to administer that. We could potentially have some more hunting days and things, but we don't have the funds at this point to deal with some of those things. But basically, we are right maxing out at the federal frameworks that are allowed for bag limits especially.
In Hood River, my old office was down at the marina, and we used to take walks around the port, and it's a gathering place for the geese. And it got so you couldn't walk anymore because of the feces. And one of the things on the task force, I was thinking, does it make sense to have somebody from public health also sit on that? Because I think that's a health hazard.
Not in the bill, but they could be invited, certainly, I'm sure, unless we want to take time to do amendments. You've stunned them.
Huh?
You stunned them into silence with your brilliance.
Chair Clem, Representative Van Orman, I'm not personally familiar with all the health issues and health hazards associated with goose droppings. I'm certain if you all wanted us to contact them and have them participate, either as an official member or just as, in terms of adding value to the process, we would be happy to do that.
Well, may I follow up?
Sure.
I do think that it's something to think about because we don't know much about diseases carried, but we do know about the bird flu.
Hope so better.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and a follow-up on Representative Van Ormans. Earlier in the testimony, we did hear some mention of E. coli concerns also. So, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense, actually, to at least have a participant.
Thank you, and I appreciate you guys. Don't get me wrong, but the answer, I just wasn't satisfied with it. You said you're trying to do everything. We don't have the funds to administer something. Look, you guys, you add an extra day on the hunting season. You don't need more money to do that, in my humble opinion. Let the hunters and the people take care of the problem. I beg you. You could add a week on, and you don't need any more money in the department to do that. I just don't buy that argument. You expand the hunting to the maximum level. I just don't agree with that, and maybe I heard you wrong. Maybe you need to come around and educate me on what's going on here. But I don't think we need more money for the department to add more time onto the limit, how long they can hunt out there. I do not buy that argument. Forgive me, but I'm just not buying it.
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, we're happy to come by and talk grace with you. But I just wanted to clarify what Brad Bales was referring to is in the federal framework for the goose seasons in the valley here, we have one particular subspecies, the dusky Canada geese, whose numbers are very low. And part of the federal framework, in order to have any hunting seasons here, requires that we have check stations, mandatory check stations. And so what Brad was referring to is in order to add more hunting days, and which then includes adding more staff days at check stations, which are mandatory under the framework, It costs more money. So that's what he was referring to.
If I may. Here's the money right here, guys. There it is. I'll share that with you. There's the money.
Thanks.
Let's see. Line 9, page 1 of the bill allows interests of this state and public health would be included potentially under that in the bill. John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley. Today I'm here as administrator of the Oregon Clover Commission, and that is the commission that is supported by the assessments paid by all the clover seed growers in the state, including those you've heard from this morning. I have a couple of things I just wanted to add to this discussion. First, the growers are not only bringing this bill to you and suffering the losses in their fields, they're also funding research projects to try to find control methods, non-lethal at this point. And I think it's important to know that the growers are actually putting their own funds into trying to solve this problem. And that brings up my second point that I hope the task force is going to be able to take a look at, and that's all the rules and requirements around research. There are certain ways that research has to be conducted, especially when looking at some of the products we're trying to see if they work in this area. Senator Johnson mentioned one of the products. It's a naturally occurring substance called anthraquinone. It's just been a huge challenge trying to conduct research on a very mobile pest within a very restricted area as required under the regulations that we have to follow in evaluating control measures. I have to say that the Department of Agriculture has just been wonderful to work with in allowing us whatever flexibility we can have in using these products, but they are limited. And so I'm hoping the task force can take a look at how we can effectively conduct research on products to control the populations as well. And just wanted to let you know that that is occurring.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over on the coast, you know, we hardly ever had any there, but now we're starting to have problems there. Right below where I am, every farmer along the coast, Coquille, down through Langlois, I want you to address that Langlois problem. And those numbers now, where there were none, are probably in the 20s to 40s in these areas. But over the next few years, you're going to be developing the problem down there that you have here and into the Coquille Valley, which is another 150,000-200,000 acres of pasture. And I don't know, Kurt, if you know or your staff person knows what was taking place with Scott McKenzie and the problem with the geese there at Langlois.
Chair Clemmer from Krieger, I'm not personally familiar with that. Brad, are you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. The particular subspecies that's starting to cause the problem on the south coast is the Aleutian Canada goose, which was both on the state and federal endangered species list for numerous years, but that population has rebounded at this point. The vast majority of those birds still winter in California, but we are seeing some fall migration stopping in southern Oregon and also coming back in the spring, and that's when some of the bigger issues have happened. To try to address some of those concerns, we have worked with the state of California to increase their seasons and bag limits on Aleutian Canada geese on the wintering grounds there, knowing that we need to control that population, and geese that don't come back aren't going to be causing us problems. But we've also implemented as late as possible hunting seasons with new bag limits on the south coast to try to address with that. So the traditional seasons that we had on the south coast for many years have been altered the last, I think, 3 years now to try to get at the Aleutian population more.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Are they even migrating anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in general, yes. We do have one subspecies, the Western Canada goose, or some people call it the Great Basin. In fact, I heard a pair of them squawking when I was walking up the Capitol steps this morning. There's some nesting not too far from here. Those are resident Canada geese that are here basically year-round. All the other subspecies, the cackler's Aleutians, we're still seeing the normal migrations back to the breeding grounds in Alaska primarily, but we are seeing shifts in wintering grounds. The example Kurt talked about of the cackler shifting from California, which I would note there has been no pavement of the habitat there. The habitat that they were using is still there and available. They just shifted, and we don't know why.
I wanted to ask about that. Is it do we have a drought problem in California? Is there less irrigated crops in that area? Or we just really have absolutely no idea why they don't want to go back to California. I don't blame them, first. I wouldn't go there unless I have to under armed guard. But.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that kind of sums it up in general. We don't really know why. The water issues are always a thing in California, yeah. But the pastures are still there. But I think geese in general are opportunistic. Migration takes a lot of energy, and if they don't have to fly as far and they have the food resources here, they don't need to go any further, and I think that's what they're finding. But in general, seeing the migration.
I'm in trouble now. I've opened up a terrible can of worms here. Yeah. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Aleutians, are they still one of the major food stock for the island, the Aleutian Island Native Americans? Because we had a testimony here, and a group came saying, you know, keep helping us get this bird back because it's a major food source for us. A couple of years ago, and now it sounds like it's back. Are they still using this as a food source, or are they leaving it alone up there too, which creates the additional deal of having more and more birds?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the cackling Canada goose, which is the primary one used for subsistence. The Aleutians nest out on the Aleutian Islands, and there are no villages and very hard access.
Okay.
But on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta on the west coast of Alaska, that's where cacklers are, and that's where the native Alaskans are still using them for subsistence harvest. But we are, at the same time, while we're trying to increase harvest as much as we can here, we do encourage harvest for subsistence to help control the populations also.
Okay.
The only question I guess I have is we obviously need to pass the bill. We need to have the task force. We need to try and work with the feds. We need to figure out how to manage our seasons within their limitations as best we can. Do we have any form of assistance to not the flagging and those kind of things that we help growers with, but actual compensation of any kind? I mean, do we use our access and habitat funds to, I mean, these are habitat issues. Do we assist growers with any form of assistance, you know, financially?
Chair Clem, not to my knowledge, but I'm going to say that I don't know absolutely. So, Brad, unless you...
Mr. Chair, the only program, as I think was referred to, the landowners down on the south coast, there has been some access and habitat money going in there trying to provide some hunter access on private lands with the primary purpose of dealing with some of the goose depredation issues. But that's the only one I'm aware of right now. We did, several years ago now, worked through access and habitat to try to get a program between hunters and landowners for access on hunting. It went fairly well the first year, but and I'm not really certain of the reasons, but the second year We basically just didn't have any landowners sign up for that program, and I'm not sure. I think some of it was that the landowners kind of found some hunters they liked that first year, and they really didn't see the need to be making new contacts and things like that. But as far as goose damage, I think those are the only two A&H type of programs I'm aware of.
You know, God bless those folks that use this for a food source, every single one of them. But you know what? Things change in this world. And, you know, how much are we going to put in to allowing a group of folks, a culture, to... Do we have to shut down industry in this state for the needs of a few that refuse to change? Things change. My diet is totally different than my great-grandfather's was. That is just the way it is. Should we make a law mandating that I have to, generations from now, have to do the same diet, have the same diet as I have? Which I don't think would be a very good idea, quite frankly. I did. How far are we going? And guys, you're doing a great job.
Budweiser,
I'm with you all the way. Yes, God bless every one of them. But this is just we're chasing angels around the head of a pin here, and this argument just keeps coming back. And it's absurd. It is absurd, and it's wrong. What about that guy's subsistence right there? The farmer that was just... What about his? What about the mill worker, the logger, the farmer, the rancher? These arguments are absurd. And I'm not blaming you guys. I'm just yelling into that camera. And I think you probably... you may well even agree with me. But the whole argument is just an absurd, illogical, unreasonable, irrational argument, and something... Hopefully, will be done about it.
Here, I have an idea. During redistricting, we make a congressional seat that's pretty much all of Eastern Oregon and grabs Happy Valley, and then somebody would have a proper forum to get to deal with some of this stuff. How's that?
I would love it.
That's the only idea I can come up with today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Linda Strand.
Hi, I won't take very much, pardon me, of your time. I'm a citizen who grows berries, and I thought this was Senate Bill 409, and it isn't. And so I came in to go ahead and see the government at work, and I happen to be the mother of the goose calling champion in the state of Oregon for the last 5 years.
I know
a lot about goose hunting, and so I went ahead and stayed on board and listened.
We're glad you're here.
And as I'm listening to things...
I'm sorry, I have to have you
identify
your
myself
name for the record.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. My name is Linda Strand. I live in Multnomah County. I work for a farm called Columbia Empire Farms, mm-hmm. and my son's name is Eric Strand, who I'm going to talk a little bit about. But as I'm listening to all the folks that are here and so impassioned, I had to go and get a copy of the bill and look to see to make sure that hunting was on the list. And as I heard the discussion progress, I heard hunting be included. And I hope that under the conservationists, they'll be having someone from either DU or Delta Waterfowl, that they'll have folks that are with the hunter's interests in mind. But I know that my son, and pardon me, my other part of my background is I ran the Made in Oregon stores for 23 years. And I've been involved in a lot of tourism for the state of Oregon. And something that I've never seen developed in the state of Oregon is guide services and hunting to a different degree because of some of the limitations that have to do with goose identification and the ability to hunt. And so I'm hearing about bag limits and extra days, and I'm thinking, why can you only shoot geese on one side of I-5 and not the other? And why can't you, and maybe you can think of a way for the, like the Restaurant Association has a way of doing education that would enable folks who are going to become restaurant workers. They figured out a way to do it online. Goose education and figuring out how to ID these geese with, frankly, and if you don't mind me saying it like this, men's eyes that may or may not be able to identify them clearly, depend on a guide to do so. And maybe they can figure out a way to have the education of how that goose identification could take place, and a whole lot more could get shot. I think that really limits people in goose hunting. And, you know, there's lots of other ideas. I don't want to take too much of your time. I'm just a citizen who was listening to some conversation, and I live and breathe goose and duck hunting, and I just couldn't keep quiet.
Well, so. And now you're a candidate for the task
right.
force.
Oh,
we've got your name and county. We know where you live.
Yep. My son would be possibly a better one. I'm going to see you guys later about Oregon berries. So I'll talk to you. Thanks. Is there any questions? Thank you.
I do have one.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Roblin.
Your son's goose competition?
Uh-huh.
Was that in Oregon, or is that a nationwide?
You have a state competition here, and then the national competition for duck calling is in Stuckart, Arkansas. When you go to Stuckart, by the way, it is totally works with ag. It's a rice-growing area where all of the rice growers turn their fields over to snowy white geese and lots of other varieties of waterfowl. And the hunting industry and tourism takes over from there. All the billboards are about hunters and callers, and it's tourism could also play a part. And the goose calling competition is back east. It's in Maryland.
And were you saying he won? Did your son win a particular competition, or was he just goes to all of them?
No. He is the reigning state champion.
There we go.
For Oregon.
Just wanted to make sure that got on the record.
Yeah, he is the state champion.
Eric with the K or a C?
C.
Both of you have a task force now.
There we go.
Voice of reason, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. That completes our testimony. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 6222A and open a work session on Senate Bill 6222A.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 622A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 622A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Can we get it there as soon as possible?
Clerk will call the roll, and then we will.
Representative
Byers. Aye.
Representative Gillian.
Aye.
Representative Roper.
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Oh, I thought he was.
He teleported up here.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Bill sent to the floor, and against my better judgment, Representative Shoffler.
I'd be happy to.
I'm sure you would.
Get your videos out.
Yeah, this could be good. All right.
I'll yield.
Just remember.
Yeah.
Brevity.
All,
brevity.
I don't know. We'll get your yields ready. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 625. We've got two of our colleagues here to talk about the resolution that, well, it's a Senate bill, actually, but if you look at it, I don't know how many co-sponsors you got on there, but a lot.
All but one.
All
who
but
shall
one.
Not be named.
Okay, I'll have to go do my own deductions now.
Okay. Thinking I wasn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record.
Actually, it's a key thing, because Mary Berry had everyone, died.
You gotta have one off.
Yeah, that's the new
thing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Matt Wingert, and I guess my name is not Representative Matt Wingert. My name is Matt Wingert, and I represent House District 26.
Wow. Could have had it changed.
And I could have it legally changed.
You and Jules Bailey.
Senate Bill 625 is an effort to continue something that was started in the last legislative session. It actually goes back to 01 when Greg Leo originally brought a bill to designate a day for the First Oregon Volunteers. But starting last session, we began the idea of trying to name a day of the year in Oregon after an Oregon pioneer. And this is our second attempt to do that. We did get one last session, and we have another one this session. It's probably even more fitting because we're celebrating Oregon's 150th birthday, and as a history buff myself, I think it is important for us to know our past, and it's hard to know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And Senate Bill 625 would establish February 9th as Ewing Young Day in Oregon. It's one of the most remarkable aspects of Ewing Young's life was that his death helped bring Oregon government into being. By establishing the rule of law and appointing Dr. Ira L. Babcock as Oregon's first presiding judge to probate Ewing Young's considerable estate. The earliest trappers and settlers were unsure about the need for establishing a government. Most of them had spent years trapping beavers throughout the western wilderness. When Ewing Young died on February 9th, 1841, there was no immediate heir and no probate court. The day after Young's funeral, on February 18, 1841, the Reverend Jason Lee met with the settlers to discuss the situation. Dr. Babcock, the doctor at Lee's Willamette Mission, had a set of law books from the state of New York, which he used to settle Young's claims, collect his debts, and sell his Chehalem Valley farm to Sidney Smith, who had worked with Young and cared for him in his declining days. Some of the proceeds were used to build a jail in Oregon City. Some were later paid out to a son of Young's who came to Oregon years after his death. All of the records of this probate are kept in detail in the Oregon State Archives. But the legacy of Ewing Young's life, death, and probate are clear. The first form of government in Oregon had been established. The Wolf meetings that followed further detailed the kind of government early Oregonians wanted, which led to the formation of the provisional government at Shampui on May 2nd, 1843, depicted by the mural behind the dais in the Oregon House Chambers. In another significant way, the death of Ewing Young marked the transition from an unsettled and uncivilized Oregon to a place with more American settlers arriving each year in the great westward migration. Property rights were very important to these settlers. Without the rule of law, courts, and the ability to establish and defend land claims, settlement would have been much more uncertain for the new arrivals. The seeds of Oregon government, sown by the death of Ewing Young and germinated in the political discourse of the Wolf meetings, created the beginnings of the government we have in Oregon today. For this reason and many more, I urge this House Committee to favorably consider Senate Bill 625. So that each year on February 9th, we may remind Oregonians that the death of Ewing Young on this day in 1841 created the birth of the state of Oregon that we live in today. Thank you.
So just for your comfort, Representative, I went over to the Senate to testify for the first time this session on a bill and again, started to call him House, and then I started to refer to myself as a senator once again. I said, oh, Peter Courtney's going to be down here any second slaying me, and caught it in time.
Mr. Chair, you two can change your name legally to right. Senator.
You already asked Ben, Claire, Jim.
Welcome.
Thanks, Chairman Clem, members of the committee. I am Kim Thatcher. You'll be laughing. And I represent Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg. And this, I'm proud to sponsor this bill for my constituents in Newburg, especially because Ewing Young was the first settler in what is now Newburg. This is a man, you got to think of the good Western movies that you might have watched on a Saturday afternoon. That's his life right there. He was friends with many of the best-known trailblazers in the Western wilderness and, of course, kind of helped grow the state to where we are today. He was a trapper, a trader, a trailblazer, and as stated, he was instrumental in settling the Willamette Valley and helping create economic independence for Oregon's earliest settlers. And he mentioned his death, so that's kind of through his death that American self-styled government in Oregon was established. This bill would make February 9th on each year Ewing Young Day, and his legacy is a creation of Oregon's first government. Ewing Young was the first settler in Chehalem Valley. He settled in a spot across from Shampui, which is, obviously I said it was part of Newburgh, but he played a key role in breaking the British Hudson's Bay Company monopoly over the beaver economics of early Oregon. He built sawmills and ranches. He established a trading center and Oregon's first moonshine still. He took, well, he gave that up eventually. He was Jason Lee got
pressure,
to him. Yeah, he handled pressure.
Gave it up under pressure.
Yeah, he was one of Oregon's most significant pioneers. In fact, his memory lives on today in what is today Ewing Young Elementary School in the Newburg School District. And I will be working on a fitting commemoration for him then in next February. Preserving Oregon's heritage has always been very important priority for my district because I am honored to have part of Shampooig Park in my district, and I'm very happy about that. But in 2007, he mentioned earlier, we passed a resolution in support of Robert Newell, and that was the other Oregon pioneer who we are preserving his legacy. And I ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. Questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Matt, can I call you representative? I really appreciate
that. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, you can call me anything that you would like.
Thank you. Well, not on record. Now,
let a straight man here. That's what I'm
doing. Thank you so much for bringing this forward, and it was really one of the worst read things I've heard. But you are honoring a great American and Oregonian, and I'm wondering, on the day that we take this to the floor, have we got plans for kids from your district, either one, to participate? Because I think this would be a great opportunity if folks want to come to the Capitol.
Definitely.
Probably already thought about that.
Let me have Greg address that.
Chair Clem, members of the House Agriculture Committee, Greg Leo, President of the Friends of Historic Shampooig, we brought forward this bill. Yes, Representative Gilliam, we will have students from Ewing Young Elementary School outside of Newburgh. They were, in fact, in the Senate chamber for the consideration on the Senate side. Senator Larry George is actually one of the graduates of Ewing Young Elementary School, and had his civics teacher with him in the chamber. Wow. Apparently, we got this on the record, that Senator George was, in fact, a good student when he was in elementary school, which was good. But we do intend, really, for this bill to be a teaching moment for all Oregon students about early Oregon and really link us with our past.
We just need to check what a citizenship grade was, because academics is different than behaving as somebody at the end of the dais knows about my report card.
I didn't have either one, Mr. Chair. But here I am all the same.
Any further questions for these folks? Greg, did you want to give additional testimony?
Yes, I will. Just to kind of give a little agricultural spin here on this, because it is an important agricultural story. When Ewing Young first came into the Willamette Valley, he called it horse heaven. And you can imagine, it was about this time of the year. It was probably the highest, greenest grass he had ever seen coming from the southwest. And, of course, he brought up a remuda of horses that he had driven from the Bay Area, which really helped the settlers first, you know, have horses that they needed to settle the area. Oregon was really in transition. It had been a place of trappers who had come across the mountains. You know, really, this is just a few years after Robert Newell had kind of blazed the Oregon Trail, and this was the first trail up from the south. When he brought the Spanish cattle, the 630 Spanish cattle mentioned in the bill, up to the Willamette Valley, it really kind of broke the monopoly that the Hudson's Bay Company had on early Oregon. And in a way, it brought about the wolf meetings, because, and this is to Representative Krieger's you know, comment earlier about wolves and predation in Oregon, that predation did become a major problem once we had livestock in the Willamette Valley. And so the wolf meeting was the reason, but the real topic of discussion was self-government and protection of citizens, you know, from other kinds of threats. And then really it was about creating the first American-style self-government. And this is like a town meeting. So the wolf meetings occurred at Shampooig and eventually led to the May 2nd, 1843 divide that you have in the, you know, beautiful Barry Faulkner mural behind the dais. And so when we look at the Oregon Pioneer on top of our building, or we look at the mural behind the dais in the House chamber, we think of that spirit of Oregon, of these enterprising people who, you know, pushed civilization really to the end of the earth as they knew it, and they created a great place based on agriculture. It was really about getting livestock there so settlers would have, you know, the wherewithal to really stay and create the Oregon we know today. So we ask for your support of Senate Bill 625. It's a great teaching moment for students. It is unusual in one aspect. We normally celebrate birthdays, but I think it's appropriate that we actually celebrate the death of Ewing Young, because out of his death, he was the richest man in Oregon. When he got to the Chehalem Valley, he claimed 50 square miles in all directions. That's some of the best land. And, of course, before the Donation Land Claim Act, anybody could claim whatever they settled on. And so it really did raise the idea that we needed the rule of law to probate its estate, to be able to, you know, enforce land claims, to provide for the protection of the citizens, and do all those basic things that government do. So it's really a story about Oregon government.
Representative Shoffler. Thank you. This is a great story. I'm currently reading about Granville Stewart. He was a pioneer in Montana. But I look forward to reading Mr. Young's story, too. And the reason he saw all that beautiful grass is because all them damn geese weren't here yet.
I thought it, actually. I just didn't want to say it.
Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler, I'm sure they would have a goose meeting.
A goose meeting.
So prior to the DLC, he claimed 50 square miles in all directions?
That's right.
That's, yeah. See, whatever the original five generations back came after it, got 40 acres, and they named it McFarland down near Harrisburg, but probably was encroaching right on the edges if it was in the Willamette Valley, because it's not that far down there. Interesting.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, the first map of Oregon has Shampooey reaching all the way to the Rocky Mountains and the Tualatin going to 5440, which they did not fight over eventually. So
right.
They had a larger view of things.
Having lived in Oregon City for 32 years and served on the city commission during the city's sesquicentennial, steeped in Oregon history, how important it is for all of us to be aware of our heritage, and I think this is a wonderful thing to do.
Okay, and I forgot it. We've got to adjourn by 9:30 for floor, so I'm going to move us along to passing your bills.
Thank you.
Let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill. That was our last witness. 625, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 6. No, open a work session on Senate Bill 625.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 625 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 625 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Healy. Aye. Representative Shelton. Aye. Representative Wendell. Aye. Vice Chair Van Orden. Aye. Vice Chair Green. Aye. Chair Clinton. Aye.
Motion passes. Bill sent to the floor. You know, I was tempted to make the representative from the economic hub of Lane County have to carry this resolution, but I think it would be more appropriate to have our two representatives be co-carriers on this. So Representative Wingard and Thatcher. I don't know. He's the only one missing on the resolution. I'm going to give him grief about it all day today. It's going to be great.
Oh, is he the only one?
All right. It took me a while to do my math on that. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 639A. He was probably scratching
it. Well, one, we can mention the cattle drive that it came through. Like, we'll find many ways to mention Lane County in the person.
Darren Padgett, Tammy, I thought you spelled your name different. Denny and Katie Koba. There was an H and a Y in there somewhere. I'm sorry.
Okay, so we're on 639.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Darren Padgett. I'm vice president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League this year. Not done this before, so Tammy's done all the groundwork for me, and Director Koba, I guess, is right on board with everything. So Tammy makes it easy to do this job. I understand you have the testimony in front of you, so I'm just here to endorse and hopefully move this along. Kind of a matter of housekeeping. I am a farmer in southern Sherman County, probably one of the poster child for the true family farm. We're not the biggest, we're not the smallest. My wife and I manage it, no off-farm income, fourth generation, on and on. Representative Shoffler's brother probably buys about half my crop. Give you a little perspective, my farm, if you figure 72 loaves of bread out of a bushel of wheat produces about 6 to 8 million loaves of bread a year. The last little batch of rain went through produced an additional million loaves of bread off of my farm alone. And probably at $5 wheat, another $6,750 to Oregon State's bottom line. in taxes at $5 a bushel. So, and that's just my little part of the world. Anyway, we just urge that this get passed. It's just basically housekeeping. The bottom line is that the big changes were that we want to add two additional voting members on the commission for the representatives of the wheat industry, like a grain buyer or shipper. Authorizes the elimination of the public member position in the unlikely event that refunds of assessment are to be considered, clarifies the processes for appointing and removing of members, and makes permanent the sunset provision scheduled to expire in January 2010. No cost to the state, just kind of cleans up what we do, and business continues on. So, any questions for me?
Representative Schaffler.
Only to say, Mr. Chair, I just like the first bill we heard, I don't think people that don't live in God's country and haven't any experience out in on farm and ranch areas or in woodlands really understand the magnitude of this part of our economy and this rich resource we have here. And I don't think we in this building, or some of us, or a lot of us that work here, really appreciate what's going on out there enough. And I just want to thank you for everything you're doing. And hopefully this will help shed a little light on the wealth we are blessed with in this state.
Thank you. Tammy, are you good?
No, Mr. Chairman, but for the record, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. Very proud to reside in Eastern Oregon, God's country, as we like to call it, over there in the land of Letterbuck. Happy to represent our 4,000 wheat producers and landowners across the million acres of wheat production in the state each year. So thank you very much for hearing this bill this morning, and we do urge passage of Senate Bill 639A. Thank you.
Great. Director Koba.
Mr. Chair, members, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture, just here to indicate the department's support for Senate Bill 639. Is it A, amended?
Yes.
A. Representative Van Orman.
Well, just for the record, since Representative Schaffler may have impugned my character, I would like to point out that my children's great-grandfather was an early pioneer wheat rancher in the Dalles.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't speaking to Representative Van Orman.
I just want
I'm talking about all those people that live in a concrete jungle that want to attack banks.
It wasn't necessary.
You laid their driveways. What are you upset about? All right. thank you so much. We'll get this bill moving.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close. That's the end of our list. Close our public hearing on Senate Bill 639A and open a work session on Senate Bill 639A.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 639A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 639A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Byron.
Aye. Representative Young.
Aye.
Representative Russell.
Aye.
Representative Charles.
Aye.
Representative Wigger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Chair
Casey. Aye. Motion passes. Bill sent to the floor. Do you have any objection to the consent calendar for this one?
No. Good place for it.
Okay. Oh. Place the bill on the consent calendar. Open a public hearing on SCR 9. And Danielle and Gary, you want to come up?
Get your phone on.
Someone, I don't know.
Somebody's phone is on.
Danielle.
Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. My name is Danielle Welliver. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. On behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, I urge the committee to approve and recommend passage of SCR 9. As the resolution makes clear, David Lett pioneered the cultivation and making of Pinot Noir in Oregon and was a pioneer in Oregon's land use planning system as well. The hill lands around Dundee that David and Diana Lett selected as ideal for wine grapes in 1966 were identified by county planners in the early 70s as appropriate for large lot residential development. David, along with his vintner colleagues, David Edelsheim, Bill Blosser, Dick Ponzi, and others, worked hard to help the Yamhill County Planning Commission understand the value, both existing and potential, of those hill lands for agriculture. With the passage of Senate Bill 100 and the adoption of the statewide planning goals under the Act, David and his colleagues were able to save farmland that planners had written off as marginal. Today, the Red Hills of Dundee enjoy international renown as prime vineyard territory. That experience wasn't lost on David. He became a lifelong supporter of Oregon's land use planning laws and of agricultural land protection through planning and zoning. One way which he expressed that advocacy was by serving for 30 years until his passing in October as on the board of directors of Thousand Friends of Oregon. We are proud of our long association with David Lett. All Oregonians can rightfully be proud of what he accomplished for Oregon. SCR 9 is a fitting tribute to him and his contributions to our state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers. David Lett, as was noted, was a pioneer in Oregon as a vintner and a wine grape grower. One of the most outstanding contributions he made, among others, as one of the pioneers of our industry, was the commitment to quality. Pinot Noir is not the most popular varietal in the world, but when it is made at the high quality that Oregon's wine industry has committed itself to, it can be an outstanding wine, and in fact it has won international acclaim because of that commitment to quality, and a lot of it can be traced to David Lett. His legacy at Eyrie continues with his son, and if you ever wanted to taste some of the best Pinot Noir produced in Oregon, Jason Lett's Black Cap, if you can find it, is well worth the price. We commend your support for SCR 9.
Questions? All right. I think we're going to close our public hearing on SCR 9. Open a work session on SCR 9.
Mr. Chair, I'll move SCR 9 to the floor with a do pass.
Representative Krieger moves SCR 9 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Meyer.
Aye.
Representative Gillen.
Aye.
Representative Roper.
Aye.
Representative
Schaffer. Aye.
Representative
Weiner. Aye.
Vice Chair
Benner.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Friedman.
Aye.
Chair.
Aye. Motion passes. Senate bill sent to the floor. We'll have Representative Widener carry it. He's our House sponsor on the bill. And with that, we'll adjourn the House Committee on Ag, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. Thank you.